Welcome back to the Hydrogen Bar and welcome back to your favorite podcast on hydrogen and fuel cells. We are very happy that you have tuned in for this episode once again. And of course, first I want to welcome my friend Johannes. Hello, Johannes.
Hello, Martin.
And we are extremely happy and feel very honored about having a very special guest here today. We are speaking with David Hart from E4Tech. So thank you very much, David, for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Martin, for the invitation. It's an honor to be here, and I'm looking forward to an interesting discussion.
Yeah, we are doing so as well. It's really an honor to have you here. Maybe for the people who don't know you, do you want to give a short introduction about yourself and your background and how you got into hydrogen, maybe?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So, as you say, my name is David Hart. I'm a director of E4Tech. We're a specialist consultancy working in the energy transition, and I head up all of our work in hydrogen and fuel cells, which these days is a lot, which is great. Mm-hmm. It's really, really exciting. But this all started for me 25 years ago, quite a while. So I did mechanical engineering. I went to work in Japan. When I was in Japan, I saw a fuel cell. I didn't know what it was. I didn't understand it. And as part of my journey in engineering, I discovered I was really very interested in energy and in the environment and other aspects. So I went to Imperial College to do a master's course looking at those things. I specialized in fuel cells. I ended up doing a PhD on hydrogen energy systems at Imperial College back in London. I ran a research group for a while, and this was all in the early 90s where everything was in flux. There was a lot of interest around hydrogen and fuel cells. There was the tech bubble building, and it was a really good time to be learning and participating, and there were relatively few people doing it. And ever since then, it's been a fascinating area for me. It's been a passion, and I've been lucky enough to be able to make a transition from research at Imperial, where I still am a visiting professor, to E4Tech and consulting and answering kind of the business questions that are related to hydrogen and fuel cells. Mm-hmm. And what's wonderful is that back in those days, there was a small but vocal minority who were interested in hydrogen, and now there's a real feeling of momentum. There's a real feeling that they will help us with the energy and climate transition, and so it's great to be part of that wave, part of that momentum.
Okay, so some of our listeners who also speak German might know your company or might remember your company from the discussion we had with Franz Lehner a few weeks ago, who was a colleague of you. I think he left the company, but we can say he introduced us and he arranged our discussion today. So, thank you very much, Franz. If you are listening, thank you very much. And David, one of the many things that you are doing is you issue or you bring out yearly the fuel cell industry review, which is some kind of report that takes a look at the current status of the fuel cell industry. Can you explain or can you describe what brought you to this idea or what's the intention of issuing this yearly report?
Yes, happy to. So actually, it wasn't our idea. Originally, the review started with Fuel Cell Today, which some of your listeners will remember, which was essentially an outreach activity run by a team within Johnson Matthey many years ago. And they did a lot of interesting analyses, and they produced this annual review. But in 2013, they decided not to continue. That was their last review. And we had always found it useful, and we always understood that it was very valuable to have an objective view about how the industry was developing with data, specifically with data, so that the industry could measure itself, so that investors could look and understand, so that politicians could understand, and something that was also accessible to the general public. So something readable, not a detailed academic report. And so I said, well, you know, maybe we can pick up where they left off. And they were very happy to say, yes, please do. And so we started gathering data and put together news reports and really constructed our first version of the industry review in 2014. And it was really well received. So people were very appreciative that we'd taken the time and energy to do that. And we've always had very, very positive feedback. It's really very well received from all of those people that I talked about, from within the industry, from outside the industry, investors. I see it cited all the time. So it's great. And, you know, we don't get paid for it. It's something that is an investment on our part, but it's really good for us as well. It means we get to talk to a lot of people, ask them questions about shipments. And of course, you know, it is, of course, marketing as well. It gives us good brand recognition. I remember a trip to China not that long ago where I went to a conference and I started handing out my business card. I said, oh, you know, we're a small consulting company. And I handed them my business card and they said, oh, yeah, we know you. Industry Review. So it was great.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah. But it's really the case that basically this is kind of the first document that you get handed over when you say, I want to know something about this industry. And it's really an very amazing feat that this is done for free from your company. So they're also kind of the thanks from my side, because I'm also reading this, of course, every year. And it provides a lot of insights, and it's really great that this source is publicly available. So you as listener can, of course, also go to the website and download it. We put this link into the show notes. But yeah, today we want also to talk about the latest issue of this fuel cell industry review of 2020. But going to this 2020, how would you say has the industry evolved now, where you basically really witnessed the pulse of this industry for 7 years now, right? If my math is correct. what is your feeling about the development of the industry?
It's a great question, and it's interesting because you're right. We get a sense as we're compiling this of things that are strong and things that are weak. And we try and bring those out a little bit. Obviously, we try not to be too rude about anybody, but we're able to write what we feel as much as possible. And the thing that I think is very striking about 2020 is resilience. So at the beginning of 2020, we were very bullish. You know, we said, at the end of our 2019 report, we said we think things are going to grow really fast. There's a lot of enthusiasm. There's a lot of policy measures. And of course, you know, 2021 was not like anybody expected. But the industry, it didn't just survive. It actually grew. It didn't grow enormously, but it did grow. There were areas where the supply chains, although they were in difficulty because components couldn't be manufactured in factories that were under COVID restrictions, et cetera, the supply chains held up. So there were some delays. And the policy makers actually started looking around and making stronger policies. Mm-hmm. So we were really pleasantly surprised when we finished compiling the figures, because we were very worried that the numbers were going to go down and it was going to tell a terrible story, that the numbers had gone up and that the industry was still there. And there were very few companies that really got into major difficulty last year. There are always one or two. You know, in any growing industry, there will be one or two companies who don't make it.
Which would happen in any year, maybe. So
exactly,
not specific to 2020.
No. You're quite right. And in fact, there were far more positive stories, big deals, big investments, announcements of new factories, all of those sort of things. So it was really, really very positive. And I think that was what stuck with me is this feeling that there is now enough strength in depth in the industry that even if things get a little tough in the near term, that they'll still make it through, and costs will come down and supply chains will get stronger and there will be more applications rolled out, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it was really comforting in a sense.
When I checked through the 2020 report for the first time a few weeks ago, the first thing that struck me was of course the pictures or the graphics that you were showing. And you normally have two of those graphics on one page, and the first always shows the number of fuel cell units shipped per year, and the second always shows the power output of those units. And what strikes me the most is, of course, the fact that the pure numbers are growing, yes, but not in the same way or at the same speed as the power of those units is growing. So this would mean that there's a pretty clear trend from my perspective that the units that are shipped are getting bigger and bigger. Is this correct?
That's exactly right, and the numbers are even more pronounced if you go back in time. So currently, we show the last 5 years, so 2016 to 2020. Before that, there was a period where a lot of very, very small units were being shipped, so sort of educational size, a few lots. Yeah. And that really skewed the numbers. So it was great to see big numbers, but there was tiny, tiny amounts of power. And what we're seeing is we're seeing larger fuel cells in stationary applications. So we're seeing the kind of power generation, prime power, CHP, growing slowly. We're seeing a lot going into, particularly into cars, but into vehicles more generally. And those units are much bigger than a lot of the other fuel cells. So if we take an example, the Japanese Enifarm program, which is units which go into residential apartments, they're less than a kilowatt each. There are hundreds of thousands of them, and they've been a fantastic success story for how policy can drive a market, but they don't amount to an enormous amount of megawatts. And a single fuel cell car is, roughly speaking, 100 kilowatts, so it's more than 100 of those units just in one car. And that's exactly what makes the difference. And the important thing there is that, basically speaking, it's power that reduces cost. So you can make 100,000 very tiny units, you won't make much difference to cost. But if you make lots more megawatts, then that does bring cost down.
So these large stationary fuel cells, I was just wondering, how are they used then? Like, because this Enifarm, I think this is mainly promoted for also like earthquake safety or reliability, having still power when the earthquake strikes in Japan. But we always hear that, fuel cells are still kind of an expensive niche market. And then I was wondering, like, these stationary fuel cells, where is there the use case for this? Or are these then still kind of pilot project, but just on a large scale?
So I think the important point here is that all of these markets, with one or two exceptions, which I'll touch on, are driven by policy. Purely by policy. So the Enifarm program was very strongly supported by government with a view to doing a number of things. One was promoting local industry in Japan, One was increasing energy efficiency in the system, and so there's a CO2 reduction that goes along with these units. It's not huge, but if you multiply that by 300,000 units, then it's not trivial. And there are other different policy measures in different places. So the two main markets for large-scale stationary are Korea and the US. And Korea has a very, very strong policy mechanism called the Renewable Portfolio Standard, where power producers have to have a certain percentage of renewables in their portfolio. And that goes up every year. Mm-hmm. And what has happened in Korea is that up until now, fuel cells have been counted as part of that renewable percentage, even though they might not run on renewable hydrogen. So it was a way of pushing mm-hmm. a technology. What Korea is doing now is changing to a hydrogen portfolio standard because they've had a lot of success in rolling out the big stationary units. And there are hundreds and hundreds of megawatts deployed in Korea of large stationary fuel cells because mm-hmm. of this mechanism. And in the US, some of the individual states have had tax rebates and there's been a federal tax rebate and there have been other incentives. And the other driver has been Bloom Energy, which has found a model which works in terms of being able to finance units that go to clients where they sell electrons, and that kind of finances the relatively high capital cost of the unit compared with some of the competing technologies. So those are the two winning areas. I think, you know, this all helps to drive volume up. And this helps to drive costs down. And what we are increasingly seeing is things starting to become competitive on their own with less policy support. And that, I think, is important because you're right. They have been a bit of a niche. They've been expensive. And we're just seeing a change now. And with increasing interest in improving air quality and in reducing CO2, I think the drivers will get stronger and stronger.
Mm-hmm. A possible application for stationary fuel cells would also be installing them in private houses or small businesses and using them for producing heat and electricity. We have a couple of players here in Germany who would generally be able to provide or to sell such units. There is Weiland and there is Wiesmann and a few more. And I think we have been talking about this kind of product for years. I remember we were part of a small project in this area about 10 years ago, maybe. Yeah. What are the reasons, from your perspective, that this technology has not yet lifted off?
You're right. The technology has been developed for that area. That's exactly the kind of area that the NFARM program in Japan has targeted. And mm-hmm. you're right again that there are companies, particularly around Germany, but one or two others, who have looked at this in the past. What has really been lacking up until now in Europe is a strong policy mechanism. So there is now one in Germany. There is the KfW 433 program, which supports micro CHP and is particularly good for fuel cells of, I think, up to about 5 kilowatts. And that has resulted in a reasonable number of systems being shipped. You know, it's a few thousand, mm-hmm. which is quite good. It's not enough to fully drive costs down. I think the difficulty for residential scale fuel cells has come in a couple of places. One is market liberalization of electricity markets in particular, which means that it's very easy for customers in most countries to switch supplier. Mm. And if your electricity comes from a fuel cell which is owned by you or owned by someone else, mm-hmm. then there's a question about who owns the fuel cell if you switch supplier and if you can switch supplier, all of those things. So that's one issue. The other is simply the economics. As Johannes, I think, mentioned earlier, it was, you know, these things have been expensive. They remain somewhat expensive. And in a lot of countries, the price of a gas boiler or some equivalent and electricity from the grid is sufficiently low or sufficiently affordable that buying an expensive CHP unit, even if it's more efficient and even if it might pay back over maybe 6 or 7 or 8 years, isn't very promising. Mm-hmm. So those have been the issues. I think we'll see a bit more traction as prices come down. The other area which is worth talking about is data centers, and a lot of the companies who are looking at this scale of fuel cell are very interested in providing power to data centers, which are ever more power hungry. The data center providers need to go to zero emissions. It's part of their mandate. It's part of their defense of the fact that they're using more and more electricity. And there is a good case for fuel cells, even running on natural gas, which won't get you to zero, but also running on hydrogen.
With these data centers, then the model would be that they use natural gas in the beginning or hydrogen that is made from steam methane reforming, and then just are prepared already once the green hydrogen comes to kind of be completely carbon neutral. Is this the thinking behind?
The thinking varies a little bit by location and by company. That's definitely one model, is using either using natural gas from the grid, which as I say doesn't get you to zero emissions, but does, because of the efficiency of the fuel cell, get you to quite low emissions, especially if you're comparing with something like a diesel generator, which in some cases you are. Some of them will actually already be thinking about running on renewable hydrogen, so moving directly to the end game. And some of them will be somewhere in between with a transition strategy, which starts perhaps on natural gas or on hydrogen produced from natural gas and then move to renewable hydrogen. So it's still very much in evolution, but the business case looks relatively promising, not least because what you can do with fuel cells is essentially have more or less one fuel cell per server. And so you have massive redundancy and very, very high reliability inherently, which means that it's a different concept than having grid supply and then a backup if the grid goes down. Essentially, you run these things directly off the fuel cells and almost have the grid as a backup. So the economics are different as well.
What is your feeling about ideas for off-grid and auxiliary power solutions? So recently, there have been quite a few press releases about GenCell, which is an Israeli company, and we have this company from the United Kingdom, which is supplying a portable off-grid unit for this racing league. Help me, that's sorry, that's
it's high race
electric
high race. That's but the supplier of this off-grid unit, isn't this AFC
Energy is
yeah. Thank you. What is your feeling about that? Will such units have a future, or will this on the long-term be something that can also be solved when using batteries?
I think it's hard to predict, but I'm fairly confident that we will see a lot of coexistence of batteries and fuel cells, and that as the hype dies down a bit and as this sort of slightly peculiar, aggressive confrontation dies down between people who are battery believers and people who are fuel cell believers, that we will settle to a point where the right ones are used in the right cases, and that will be defined by economics and defined by emissions and defined by other things. So I'm very confident that there is a role for fuel cells in exactly those applications. If you want long duration storage, it's quite well done with hydrogen and less well done with batteries. If you want rapid charge, discharge and high efficiency, that's better with batteries than with fuel cells and hydrogen. And I think that the exciting aspect of what we see now is that for the last 10, 15 years, longer for some companies, they've really been struggling to find a place. They've been battling to get into small markets. They've tried desperately to figure out what the cost structures and support they need to make something work. And now you can essentially buy a fuel cell off a price list. You know, it's nice. It's a nice change. And what that means is entrepreneurs are starting to think, hey, I have this problem and I can now solve it with a fuel cell, and I can go
with a fuel cell. Yeah, right.
So I think if you'd said a few years ago, oh, by the way, we're going to use fuel cells to charge electric vehicles, I'd have rolled my eyes and said, really? That sounds crazy. You know, why would you do that? But in some cases, it makes sense. If you have no grid infrastructure, or you have a grid infrastructure with a bottleneck in it, then do go round it, do something else. It does make sense. So I think what we should be cautious about is being absolutist. I've learned the hard way that I've in the past made fun of ideas which I thought were not very sensible from maybe an engineering perspective, and they've turned out to be a really good success. So I'm very cautious about taking positions on those things now.
Now, you said before that the large volumes, especially in megawatt, produced are key for the cost reduction to realize the scale effect. And as you also said, the electric vehicles are kind of a multiplier because they have these huge fuel cell systems in there. How important do you see this industry, this kind of vehicle industry, for the growth of this market and for the scale up of this market? Like, can we scale and reach lower prices also without having significant amounts of vehicles on the road?
We can, but it will take longer, and we won't get some of those benefits. And you're exactly right. The vehicle market is important for two reasons. One is that there's a lot of volume, and so you can drive some of the supply chain prices down relatively quickly. The other is that automotive people, their life is about reducing costs from systems. And so they're very, very good at managing supply chains, specifying supply chains, and taking cost out. So it's a really important driver. Of course, not all fuel cells will go into vehicles, particularly some of the larger and high temperature versions. You won't put molten carbonate fuel cells into vehicles, except possibly ships. So they won't be affected in the same way by cost reductions, but it is otherwise quite important. That said, you don't need millions of vehicles in order to get the cost down a long way. If you want to get a significant way down the cost curve, then tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of vehicles already gets you in a good position. And we're starting on that journey now. So if you look at what happened, you know, there were about 10,000 cars on the roads in Korea last year. So that's a really good start. And there should be more this year. There should, you know, that should continue to grow. Mm-hmm. And that will help the supply chain, the buying power, the innovation, all of those things that you need to get cost out.
Since we have once again reached our 30 minutes time limit, I suggest we continue this very interesting discussion about the vehicles next week with the next episode. And I want to thank you very much, David, for today, for these very interesting insights, and for issuing the report in the first place, of course. Thank you very much for that as well. And we'd love to continue this discussion with you in 1 week.
Of course, no, I'd be happy. I think we're just getting going, so it's a great cliffhanger to leave your audience with, and I look forward to the continuation.
So I hope the audience will forgive us and will some kind of enjoy this break, and we'll hear each other again next week or the next episode. And in the meantime, if you want, check out our website, which is hydrogenbar.net. And you can also send us an email using a contact@hydrogenbar.de. Oh, that's a very complicated in German email address, but I think you will figure it out if you want to send us an email. So thank you very much once again for listening, and we'll talk to you once again next week. Thank you.
Thank you very much. See you soon. Bye.
Thank you.